It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch. This is, I think, the last show of the year? No, we have one more show because we have one that's going to take place, next week. But this will be the show that takes place before, Christmas. So, cool. It's good to have you guys here. And for those who are just joining us, we're also live on Facebook, i.e. Facebook Live. So you can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Blog Talk Radio. You can find us on iHeartRadio. Now you can find us on Facebook Live. Norma Mendez is watching from New York. Hi, Kathy. Kathy, where are you from? We have Kathy Cook coming in as well. And so we have tons of people joining us there on Facebook Live, and we appreciate it very much. Today, we have a very special, this is Jackson, one of our regular contributors. He's going to be helping us out with Veterans Disability. Kathy Cook from Reno, Nevada. Thank you for chiming in. And so we have Steve G. Jones joining us, Andrew Ajemi, and Mary King rounding out the show. So just a fabulous show, and we're not going to waste any more time. We're going to jump into it. My first guest, Francis Jackson. As I mentioned, he's one of our regular contributors. But he's also an attorney who specializes in disability law for those seeking veterans disability benefits, as well as Social Security disability benefits. A founding partner of Jackson McNichol, he has been quoted in USA Today and is listed in Cambridge Who's Who. He was honored by the National Academy of Bestselling Authors with a Quilly Award for the book Protect and Defend. Francis Jackson, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thanks so much, Bert. Always a pleasure to be here.
You bet. And, it's always good to have you here. I've said this multiple times that the work that you guys do is so critically important, especially to the brave men and women who have been denied their benefits, the families who are waiting for those benefits. And this, of course, is not an easy process. And so the work that you guys do is crucial and probably as important as the service that these servicemen and women provided for our country. This is just as crucial for them. So it's always good to have you on the show. And I want to dive into this and talk about what has happened on the pending VA reform bill that we talked about.
Well, as you remember, Bert, when we started talking about this, it was being touted as a major reform to the VA disability compensation provisions, and to restructure that whole process to speed it up and make it more efficient for our veterans. Unfortunately, most of that has simply gotten dropped out of the bill, but it's still a pretty major bill, has lots and lots of different sections and provisions. It was very disappointing to see that they ultimately dropped all of the provisions that Secretary McDonald was pushing to try to speed up the veterans disability process. The Board of Veterans Appeals now is projecting that cases going all the way through to the board level are going to take up to 7 years. It's just getting crazy.
Yeah, it's too bad. And this is one of those things where it's so disappointing that the people who are denying these benefits are people who've never served. I guarantee you that none of these people have ever served, and they have the audacity to essentially kill the bill.
Yeah, that's seems to be the way it's happened. It's frustrating. You know, both the Chairman Miller and the Senate Chairman were behind it, as well as Senator Blumenthal, who was the minority ranking member in the Senate. And they've managed to get through a pretty big bill, but it dropped out all of the reform provisions, which are sad.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about this. Does it have any provisions for the reform of the disability compensation system, or has everything been gutted now?
Well, there's one interesting provision that they kept, and that goes like this, Bert. It would change the rules. So now, if a person is a veteran and entitled to benefits, and they die, generally speaking, if their death is related to a service-connected disability, their spouse can get what are called dependency and indemnity compensation benefits, along with pension or funeral expenses, as the case may be. And what the bill does is to take out the requirement that person file a formal claim. You have talked about the fact that used to be you could make a claim very informally, and more recently the VA now has this very formal process where you have to file a certain form and so on. But what the bill does is to go back and take out the requirement for filing that form and say that in any case where there's already sufficient information in the claim file for the VA to determine that the surviving spouse is entitled to benefits because the death was related to service, that person doesn't even have to file a claim. The VA is supposed to go ahead and assess that and pay them. So that's one nice thing that they did. On the disability compensation side, the other thing that they've done, and I think this was sort of kind of a halfway measure toward the reform part, they've told the VA to report back to Congress with quite a bit of information. They're supposed to file a report about the average length of time it takes them to adjudicate an appeal, the average length of time it takes for those things to go through the entire process. They put in a section requiring the Government Accountability Office to review all of the VA's regional offices to see if they can't have a more even performance in processing the disability claims. They've required them to submit a report within 15 months on the criteria and procedures that they're going to use to determine staffing to make all this work.
Right.
And so, they're certainly pushing in the direction of getting the VA to move these things along. It's disappointing that they dropped out the what I thought was the real heart of the bill in terms of procedures that would have made some guarantees of changes. But they're essentially giving the VA at least a temporary pass and telling them to report back and tell them what needs to be done. So we'll see where that goes.
Sure. And we're being joined by several people on Facebook Live. Dunca Maria, thank you so much for stopping by. Norma wants to know, what are we talking about? Well, Norma, right now we're talking with Francis Jackson. He's an attorney who works with veterans disability type compensation. Kathy Cook saying that her mom was working in shipping and receiving there at the base in North Carolina, Camp Lejeune. And so she has some questions regarding some pensions and disability that her mother is not able to access right now. So I'm going to refer her. I'm going to refer her to you, Francis. And so, Kathy, stand by in a few minutes. I'll connect you via email with Francis Jackson. He can talk about your case, your mom's case, and see if there's anything that he can do there. But this is the kind of thing that's so important. Our men and women who serve our country so diligently, and now after they've served, many of them cannot get any kind of disability benefits. They're struggling to get these benefits. And as we all know, a lot of our men and women come back from fighting, and they have, you know, not only physical injuries, but mental injuries, which are sometimes harder to treat. And so, absolutely. So we're going to get that information. I want to ask you this, Francis. Does it have any provisions relating to disability appeals to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims? Talk about this.
Yeah, actually, Bert, there are a couple of important provisions. You and I haven't talked about this a lot, but we've talked generally about how the appeals process has been slow and how it kind of backlogged. Part of the related problem, if you will, is that because of that, the backlog has now spread to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, and so there's an increasing number of appeals to the court. And what's happened is the court has had a number of retirements, so that the number of judges available to decide the cases has been reduced. The staffing on the court has been temporarily expanded from 7 to 9 for a while, and that provision has now ended. But the good news is that the bill does extend that provision, allowing them 9 judges through 2020 to deal with the mess that they've currently got, and hopefully by then there'll be some improvement below them, which will reduce it some. But that that alone is a very significant piece for the court. You can imagine, you know, if you add another 20% capacity, it makes a difference. And so that's a big deal. The other thing they've done is they've changed the rule. It used to be that the senior member of the court is automatically the chief judge. And the problem with that is that because a lot of these folks get appointed at roughly the same time, what will happen is there will be a period where the chief judgeship turns over very quickly as a group of people retire, so that, you know, there have actually been times in the past where a person was the chief judge literally for one day. So it's just causes a lack of continuity. What they've done in the bill is to modify the requirements so that to be chief judge, you have to be the senior most person with at least 3 years remaining on their term. And so that will ensure a greater degree of continuity at the court, which is always helpful in any institution, I can appreciate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things that is so frustrating, because the chief judge thing is just one example. I've heard similar complaints when people, you know, when veterans go to get treated, and every time they go to get treated, there's always, a new person attending them. And so it lacks that continuity. And you know, you're starting fresh with a new doctor every time you go, and they don't know anything about you. And the guy's got to spend 10 of the 15 minutes that he's going to spend with you reading your file to try to catch up. So, you know, it boggles the mind the way some of these guys are treated. Well, let me ask you this. When it comes to veteran-owned small businesses, what's the implication here? Does it help? Does it hurt? Talk about this.
Well, there are several technical provisions, but the real provision that I think will be a big deal for a small group, it'll be a very big deal for a small group of people. And it goes like this, Bert. What they've done is that if you have a small business where the owner is a veteran and entitled as a result to preferences for contracts with the government,
right.
If that veteran is a service-connected disabled veteran rated at 100%,
right.
What now happens is that if that person dies, the preference goes away. Well, what the bill does is to change that so that if the person has a spouse, that person can take over the business and retain the preference and run the business for another 10 years with those preferences. So it's a very big deal for those people. There's a related preference, which is not quite as strong. If the veteran is entitled to preference because he has a service-connected disability, but it's less than 100%, then in that case, the period for the spouse is only 3 years. But what it does is to allow those small businesses to know that if the veteran passes away from his service-connected disabilities,
right,
it doesn't mean that the business is immediately wiped out by the lack of entitlement to the preference anymore. There'll be at least a reasonable period for the spouse to make arrangements to wind down the business or sell the business, or if you're 100% service-connected, to operate for an extended period. So those are very important provisions for a very small group of people.
Okay, gotcha. All right, well, listen, my final question before you go is, in this winter season, does the bill have any provisions to help the homeless veteran?
Actually, it does, Bert. This is one area where I think they actually did something pretty good. They, as you know, there are a lot of homeless veterans. There aren't as many as there used to be. The VA really has been working very hard to try to help that group of folks. But one of the core problems has been that a lot of the folks who are homeless also have some mental health issues. And the particular group there, a lot of those folks had mental health problems while they were in the service. And so when they left the service, they may not have gotten a particularly good discharge. And one of the things that the bill does is to take the two, I guess I would say, biggest or best programs that VA has for homeless veterans, the supportive services for very low-income veteran families is one of them, and the grant and per diem program is the other. And
right,
what those programs do is essentially to take veterans who are homeless and help them get into stable housing. The two programs work a little differently, but they're both aimed at that group. And so the really important thing that they've done here, Bert, is they've taken this kind of core group of people who didn't do well in the military because of mental health problems and got less than honorable discharges, and they've said that, okay, we're going to make more of this group eligible. We're only going to disqualify people who had an out-and-out dishonorable discharge or were discharged as a result of a general court-martial. So kind of if you look at this group, you can probably see that about half the people who were previously ineligible based on what they were called bad conduct discharges, but not quite bad enough to be dishonorable or anything, those folks, a lot of whom have mental health problems, are now eligible for these programs. So I think that's a huge step. And I think, you know, right here locally, for example, the VA has been really working hard to get the number of homeless vets down, and they've dropped it probably 50% over the last 5 years. But there's a real core group that has a lot of mental health issues, and a lot of those folks have bad conduct discharges or other discharges that will no longer be disqualifying from these programs. And that's a huge big deal, because a lot of folks, you can go back as far as Vietnam. You could probably go back to World War II, but most of those folks are gone. But go back to Vietnam. What you see is there's a pattern that's pretty common. Folks to have gone into combat in Vietnam, come back, not functioned well in the state-wide military after that, and then as a result, they got bad conduct discharges, and as a result of that, haven't been eligible for a lot of these special programs that are designed to help people who had military service but aren't doing well now. And so this is really a big deal. It's a it's a relatively small group of people, but pardon me. if you've ever been to D.C. and seen people sleeping on the grates on the buildings around the Smithsonian at night, you know the kind of folks we're talking about here. And
right.
And this really will help a lot of those people, I believe. And I think it's a really well thought out provision in the bill, and I'm pleased to see that it went through.
You know, I am too. That is a little ray of hope there, a little light at the end of the tunnel for those specific people, because it only makes sense to take care of those. They still serve our country. They obviously, might have a couple of screws loose, but they still serve our country. And I love the fact that we're reaching back to take care of them. Francis Jackson, we're out of time, but thank you so much for stopping by today, helping out our veterans, our fighting, our brave men and women who take care of our country. And Kathy Cook, after the show, I will get you Francis's email, and you can contact him directly and talk about your case with about your mom's case. Francis Jackson, thank you so much for stopping by.
My pleasure, and I'll be happy to get back to Kathy as soon as I get her email.
Great. Good stuff there from Francis Jackson. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be joined by the one, the only, Steve G. Jones. And, Steve and I have been working together now for a couple of years, and it's always a lot of fun to have him on the show. We were together was it a couple of weeks ago, and did a fun video. And so I assure you that this next, segment here will be just as fun. Stand by, let me pay some bills, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. Yeah. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Are back. My next guest, Steve G. Jones. Steve G. Jones is board-certified clinical hypnotherapist. He is the author of 22 books on hypnotherapy. He's a member of the National Guild of Hypnotists, American Board of Hypnotherapy, president of the American Alliance of Hypnotists. Steve G. Jones works with some of the top CEOs and celebrities around the country, around the world, really, and you can see him on all sorts of different shows. All you have to do is Google his name, Steve G. Jones, and you'll see what he's been up to. He's also on the board of directors of the Los Angeles chapter of the American Lung Association, director of the California State Registered Steve G. Jones School of Hypnotherapy, and in order to keep up with the latest in research, he regularly attends training conferences. And Steve G. Jones, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hey, great to be here, Bert. Thanks for having me back.
You bet. Well, we got some people waiting for you. Norma Mendez says, hi, Steve. Heard you were in New York. How's it going? Anyway, we're on Facebook Live, and we're already getting comments regarding Steve G. Jones. So how are you enjoying New York?
New York. Well, I've been bouncing back and forth between New York and some other states. I will say New York is beautiful, busy, and chilly.
Yeah, I bet you it is chilly, and I bet you it is beautiful. I love the picture on Facebook. You were there in Battery Park, and kind of a neat shot. One of my favorite places in New York is Battery Park. It's just a neat place to go people watching.
Yeah, absolutely. Right near the financial district, so a lot of good stuff going on there. A lot of history, and they made it very walkable. So that's what I like most about it.
Absolutely. Well, listen. You know what? We didn't pick a topic to talk about, which has become kind of our norm now. And so you know, any particular topic that you want Steve and I to talk about, now is your chance there on Facebook Live to send us a comment. What should we talk about? Or Steve, do you have a topic that you want to, that you want to maybe discuss, anything on your mind?
Well, I think last year this time we talked about controlling spending, but we also have, because of the holidays, people tend to overspend. But we also do have the new year coming up. So, you know, new year, new you, getting set on motivation and objectives and things like that.
Let's talk about that, because you know what? You know, not only do people overspend, they get stressed out about it. They get stressed out about creating the perfect holiday, whether it's Hanukkah or whether it's Christmas. They want that perfect holiday. And so, you know, when I look at these individuals who are getting stressed out, they're focused, I think, on the wrong thing. And so you need to focus on the reason for the holiday. And really, most time, the reason is family, getting together. We're celebrating our religious beliefs. And I think that's where the focus needs to be on versus having a perfect holiday where all the stress comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to someone last night who's pretty typical of people this time of year. She's got a lot of relatives coming in. Some, she's in the middle of the country, but the United States, but she's got some relatives coming from the East Coast, some from the West Coast. And rather than being excited about it, she's very stressed out about it. You know, how am I going to host these people? There are also some unresolved issues with one of the relatives that need to be discussed. So rather than bring good holiday cheer into her life, it's just bringing a tremendous amount of stress.
Holiday stress.
Holiday stress. So, I have a recording for that.
You know what? And so I was gonna say that. I was gonna mention the fact that at cgjones.com there is a plethora, literally the world's largest audio collection of hypnotherapy. Audios. And so if you're getting stressed, it may be a perfect time for you to go over there and check it out. And I think that, you know, this is really where you and I have talked about this before, where whatever we focus on expands. So if you're focused on all these people and the you know, and the stress, and you're feeling overwhelmed, then that only gets bigger. And it starts to, grow, becomes its own entity. It becomes bigger than life because that's what you're focused on. And I think that if you focus on, you know, the fact that you're going to create memories, the peace that the holiday is supposed to be about, then you get feeling. And so I'm a big believer that whatever you focus on expands, and I want you to talk about that.
Yeah, I think the important thing, at least for the holidays, is to keep that focus on, you know, what you're really up to. You're attempting to get together with family in most cases and exchange presents, which are physical representations of your love for each other.
Yes.
And this whole thing gets blown out of proportion and gets misassigned. The concepts get misassigned, and then we have stress being applied to it and bitterness and resentment because of having to travel and deal with the crowds traveling. And really, it starts to fall apart, and then perhaps you have that one- or two-hour period during the Christmas dinner where everything's fine, and then everybody has to figure out how to get out of there, and so you have more stress. So I really think that taking your idea of what you focus on expands, there should be a lot more focus placed on how you can get people together and have them maintain this loving, friendly spirit that everyone's trying so hard to capture in their Facebook photos for the holidays, and really have that as a reality. Yes, we are having fun. We are in a relaxed place. We do enjoy each other's company. Yes, life happens. There are some stressful things. But I really think this whole thing, family by family, and this is an individual thing, can be re-engineered in such a way that it actually works for everyone.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that we started doing to help everybody with the stress is you can put a limit on the amount of gifts you're going to give or the amount of money you're going to spend on gifts. And that immediately you know, ratchets down the stress. Kathy Cook is reaching out saying that she listens to your relaxation audios on cgjones.com. And Norma is mentioning that, you know, she's stressed because of the financial issues that surrounding the holidays. And so, you know, again, I think that this is something that people can plan way ahead and say, listen, I don't want to spend a lot of money for Christmas. Let's just enjoy each other's company. And all of a sudden the stress will go down and you're not going to feel overwhelmed and you're not going to feel broke or anything like that. And this is something that can be a resolution. You know, you talked about the new year, the new you, and I want to talk about this because I think that money is one of those things that is so critically important, and money is sometimes not talked about, and it's one of these taboo subjects, but I think, you know, we need to get it out there and talk about it. So if you're struggling with money, you know, you need to look at why you're struggling with money, and this is something that I've been, focusing on, and that is I have found that if you're struggling with whether it's money or health or business, that sometimes we get stuck in a rut. We get stuck in our comfort zone. So, for example, in order to change things when it comes to money, we may have to start a savings plan or increase our savings program or reduce our spending in some areas of our life. All of these things are uncomfortable. You know, in some cases, we have to downsize our home or maybe downsize the car that we have in order to stay well within our budget. And so I want to get your thoughts on this as far as, how do we go about getting our, you know, we call it achieving some of these resolutions that, you know, people are going to start doing here in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, well, as we segue and look into the idea now of New Year's resolutions, I think it's really helpful if we look at things like Christmas as what they are. They are cyclical things, meaning they work in a cycle. Every year it comes around. Christmas comes around every year. New Year's comes around every year, and they're very regular. And a great way to see if you're making – what's that?
It's not a surprise.
It's not a surprise, exactly. It's like Jim Rohn says, you know, if your business goes down, well, you must be new here because nighttime follows daytime. So you're going to have the ups and downs. Yeah, and you're also going to have these cycles of coming back around to Christmas time and New Year's. And the best thing to do, in my opinion, is to take advantage of that by saying, hey, what was I working on this time last year? What was I telling myself I need to do? And the shocking, sad news is that for a lot of people, it's the exact same thing this year that they want to achieve that they wanted to achieve last year. And sometimes this has been going on for years and years. And once you realize that you're actually not making progress, if that's the case, if you're doing right. The same resolutions every year, I want to lose weight, want to make more money, etc., then make a plan and stick to it. Make this your year that you break out of the personal cycle of lack of achievement that you may be in and actually set your trajectory, set your plan, set your anchor, set your motivation for pulling yourself out of it with a plan that works. And that means it will not be the same plan that you've attempted before that didn't work. It's going to be a new plan. And the best way to do that is to look at someone who has pulled themselves out of that situation and simply do whatever they did.
Yeah, you know what? And I love that. I love that. First of all, you know, we all have access to all these people that have pulled themselves out of similar situations. And if for whatever reason, let's say you don't have the financial resources to maybe go buy some of these books and stuff or audios, you can go to the library. Your local library has tons of great books, great resources, great audios of people who were in dire circumstances and they were able to pull themselves out of there financially, physically, spiritually. So all that's available to us. You know, there's such awesome videos on YouTube, and we've already mentioned stevegjones.com. There's a lot of great audios there, and they're all, I think they're affordable to just about anybody. I don't know anybody who cannot afford them. But bottom line is, I love this idea of making a commitment to creating a plan, sticking to it, and part of that commitment is when you feel as though you're getting back into the rut, you're going to break out of that. And maybe you're going to use a book or an audio. Maybe you're going to get a coach to help you get past those sticking points, because I think a coach makes a big difference.
Yeah, that can make all the difference. You know, when I started working on losing weight and exercising regularly, I hired a coach for each of those. I have some ideas. I wanted to do things, but especially in the realm of working out, I needed new ideas
right.
I hadn't used before. So hired a dietitian, hired a personal trainer. And I think people tend to think that that's a sign of weakness if they do it. Well, if I turn to another human for help, maybe that means I don't have the knowledge I need or the stick-to-itiveness that I need. Well, I'll tell you, some of the most successful people I know use coaches. Even at the point at which they're very successful, they need a coach to make them move forward and continue doing things and innovate and continue to take these quantum leaps forward.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was getting his career started in real estate, he used a coach. When he was getting his career started in acting, he had two or three coaches. And then when he got into politics, as he was running for governor, at one point he told me he had seven coaches helping him to understand the different aspects of that career path. Seven coaches. He was literally spending 8 to 10 hours a day with coaches and studying and trying to understand what he had before him. He's a big believer in accelerating his learning curve with coaches. Our mutual friend, Joe Vitale, I mean, he's a guy who's had a coach for his guitar, just like you did. You know, his music, he hires a coach at a drop of a hat because he knows the importance of getting things done quicker with a coach.
Yeah, absolutely. I was out at our mutual friend Joe Vitale's place a couple of days ago. We were filming out there. And, we were talking about exercise and fitness. He actually built an entire fitness room. When I say room, that's an understatement. It's a facility that he built with equipment in it, and he got the right people in. So, yeah, you have to do the things that are going to make the difference. And sometimes in your mind they may seem radical, but really
right. –
these are the things that get things done. You get the right people on the bus, and then the bus goes to the right place.
Yeah, and you know, a friend of mine used to tell me that a train only, you know, how far off does a train need to be off the track before it's off the track? And he's talking about just a little bit, if that train's off its track, if it's off the rail just by, a quarter of an inch, the whole thing can be derailed. And I think humans are the same way. If we're off just by a little bit, we have massive derailment in all areas of our life. Steve, I want to thank you so much for stopping by as you travel around the country there. I'm grateful for your friendship, and I'm grateful for all the millions of people that you've helped. And if you guys have questions, you can go out to stevegjones.com and connect with Steve, or you can find him on Facebook. Steve, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Hey, Bert, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Good stuff there from my friend Steve G. Jones, Dr. Steve G. Jones, hypnotherapist to CEOs and celebrities around the world. The guy literally helps thousands of people. And again, you can catch him on various shows on TV. Just type in Steve G. Jones and you'll see it come up. Let's see. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Oh, we're not. Okay, we're just going to go straight to our next guest because we're running tight on time. And speaking of coaches, Andrew Ajemi is our next guest, and Andrew is one of those financial coaches that can help you. Andrew Ajemi, a financial strategist, he has been teaching sound financial principles, whether through the format of a seminar or one-on-one. Andrew enjoys helping people use these principles to ascertain the financial strategies that pertain to their personal situation. Andrew maintains a commitment to objective planning in the area of conservative retirement, income strategies, and the allocation of assets that preserve capital as well as allowing for growth. So, Jimmy, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Bert. Glad to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, you know what? It's always good to have you here. And, you know, we're talking about New Year's resolutions already and the fact that having a coach, having somebody to help you learn, you know, complicated things, or sometimes they're not necessarily complicated, but sometimes they're just new to us, right? And a coach
right.
will help you go faster. And I know that that's what, kind of what you do for your clients. You coach them, you help them through the very complex world of financial planning, because that is one of those areas that is new to people and is also complex.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, what I find is that people are so busy in life doing what's important to them and what they
right.
need to do, oiling the squeaky wheel, that kind of thing, that their finances oftentimes take a back seat because it's, you know, it's important, but it's not urgent and important.
Right.
So I agree with you.
Well, let's talk about this. Here we are. I want to get your thoughts on this. Let's talk about the upside potential there is in growth stocks. What do you think? What do you see?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting thing because, I think where we need to start with that is with, what are growth stocks as opposed to, I'm going to use the terminology, conservative stock. And really, conservative stock is a oxymoron. There is no such thing as conservative stock, because, right? It's still going to go up and down. It's not nothing conservative about stock, but, a conservative stock would be maybe like a blue chip stock, a large company. Maybe it's paying a dividend so that you at least get some kind of dividend even if the stock price is down, as opposed to the growth stock that's in what's considered a smaller company. And, a smaller company today is, hundreds of millions of dollars as opposed
sure.
to billions of dollars.
Right.
So, when we're talking about growth stock, that's the difference between the two different kinds of stocks. But, it's really interesting because, with the market, getting ready to push through to 20,000 point here, with the Dow getting ready to punch through that, it's interesting because whenever we're talking about growth in the market, what comes to my mind is the risk worth the reward? Because, the whole thing about investing in the market, investing in whether it's growth stocks, it's conservative stocks, whatever you're doing, you invest and you risk your money because you want a reward.
Sure.
But the question is a reward worth the risk? Right? So, over here in Connecticut, we got two of the world's largest casinos, right? And so the analogy I use is, let's say you go into the casino and they say, hey, Bert, lay down $100 here. And, you could make 10 or 20 bucks on this, but you could lose 30, 40, 50.
Right.
Do you take that bet? No. The risk is not worth the reward. You could lose 50 bucks, but you could only gain 10 or 20. That's crazy, right? So when we're talking about growth stocks in the market, we have to say, well, how much room does the market have? And it's one thing to invest when the market's high. It's another thing to invest when the market's low. So the market's very high right now. So
sure.
The thing about investing is buy low, sell high. So if you bought a growth stock right now, I would say my perspective is that you better be ready to hang on, because you could go through years without, without making your money back. How does
so
that make you feel?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know what, and what's interesting too, by the way, is you hear these stories where somebody invested, what do you call it? MCI is a great example of,
right.
For those who probably never don't even know what an MCI is, but MCI used to be
right.
one distance. But I remember when MCI was at one point trading like at a buck or two, And I remember people getting into it, and it, you know, it went up. I think it finally hit like 40 or 50 bucks, or, you know, made multiple splits. But aren't those the exception to the rule? I mean, you know, for every MCI, for every home run, you're going to have a few base hits, and you're going to have a bunch of outs.
You're exactly right. I mean, when you're talking about that, you know, if we look at, Tesla, you could have invested in Tesla 4 years ago or something in that vicinity. Well, actually, if you invest in Tesla in 2010, by the time July of 2013 came around, that $10,000 investment could have been up to, $75 million.
Say that again. So if you would have invested how much?
$10,000 in July of 2010, right?
Right.
And then July, 3 years later, Tesla, you know, it would have been worth $75 million. So it went up 645%. And at least that's what my numbers are showing. So the point being here is that, but how would you have known that?
Right. You know, because you could have invested in Tesla, and that $10,000 could have been worth $1,000, because at one point it looked like it was over for Tesla. I mean, you know,
the
big three automotive companies are gunning for them. It didn't look good.
Right. Exactly. You're exactly right. So, but you know, I'm with you from that, from the standpoint of, you know, you might to get that one growth stock. So the idea is you got to go across many. You can't say, oh, I'm going to pick this one and invest 10 grand. All I have is 10 grand to invest. I'm going to invest this 10 grand in this one. You know, you can't do that. If you're going to invest in growth stocks, you got to go across the board. You got to split up, and it's hard to know which ones to pick. You know, it's like throwing a dart. You know, you could throw a dart at a dartboard. You know, and put names of different stocks all the way around it. In the 80s and 90s, the best two decades in stock market history, it would have been a whole other thing than it is right now. You know, all you had to do is have your money in the market in the 80s and 90s, and you would have made money on it. But now, you know, since the year 2000, you know, my stance is that we're in a secular long-term bear market, believe it or not, since the year 2000, and that we're actually going to have a third drop at some point, believe it or not, you know, with the market getting ready to punch through 20,000, you know, I've got a lot of data that goes back and looks at the history of the stock market and says that, you know, we're going to have a third drop here, because historically, every long-term secular bear market. Well, let me back up for a minute, Bert. The market, in my mind, the market, the typically people say the market is unpredictable. You don't know what the market's going to do. You can't predict the market in any way, shape, or form. I disagree. I believe that there's certain repeatable and predictable trends that go on in the market. Now, we may not know when those are going to hit, but we believe that that's going to happen. And when my study of history, I've seen this, and that the full stock market cycle, the long term, is 30 to 40 years long, made up of a 15, 20 year long term bull market like we had in 1980 to the year 2000, where the market went from the Dow went from 700 to 11,700. And a 15, 20-year bear market like we had from 66 to 80 or 82, where the Dow was at 1,000 in 66, and it didn't break through 1,000 and stay above 1,000 until 1982, actually. So during those long-term secular bear markets, the market will go have 3 to 5 peaks and valleys. The second one is deeper than the first, and the third is deeper than the second, typically. And so far we've had that. The second one in 2008 was deeper than the one in 2001. And so we're anticipating the third one here, but the question is when. So when we're talking about growth stocks and especially retirees, well, is the risk worth the reward? Well, the whole thing about investing is buy low, sell high. So the market high or low right now, Bert?
Well, I think the market is very high. I think the market is so expensive. I am waiting for a little bit of a correction. They like to use that term. But I'm hoping the thing crashes so I can buy.
Right, exactly. Because you know, you're exactly right. Because you know, to be buying now, you know, historically, you're going to wait. You know, if somebody bought at the peak in 2000, it would have been 7 years before they got their money back.
Wow.
If somebody bought at the peak in 2007, it would have been 5 or 6 years before they got their money back. And
So
if people are investing in the market now, and especially people, you know, novice and the everyday, you know, mom and dad and that kind of thing, you know, they're more poised to lose. Burr, I don't know if you know this. They've done studies and found out that, you know, the whole thing about investing is buy low, sell high. Well, they've done studies on the investment public, right, the average person out there. And typically what we do is we buy high, sell low. Because we see, oh, the market is going up. I've been sitting on the sidelines too long. I'm going to jump in. And we jump in, and that's when the market goes down.
Yeah.
And
it's so funny that you should say that, because for years that was kind of my strategy. It didn't matter. I always told people it didn't matter what stock I bought. The minute I buy it, it's going to turn. It's going to go down. So what I used to do is I would buy. So if I had $1,000 to invest, I would invest like a couple hundred dollars, wait for that stock to go down, and then buy some more. that's what I did.
Great.
Now let's talk about this. I'm going to use this as an example. Years ago, before Google, there was a thing called Yahoo, and Yahoo's still around. But you know, Yahoo was one of those stocks that had no earnings. It was trading like 1,000 times expected earnings, no assets, and so people were buying it, and it was splitting, and it would go up and then split and go up and split.
Yeah.
And finally, I couldn't take it anymore, and I got out of that stock. And I know I left a bunch of money on the table, but you know what? I had made a bunch of gains.
Yeah.
And I was okay with that. And I think that what happens, my point being to all this, is that some people get greedy, and that's when they get hurt, right? Just like in the casinos. If you went to the casinos, that's probably the best time to get out of the casino.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, the two things that drive the market and our investing are greed and fear, right?
Yes.
And
this country,
we are very optimistic in this country. And I love this country. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's not the country it used to be, but it's still the best country on earth. And with that, our optimism, along with our belief in God, has gotten us out of a lot of troubles like World War II and a lot of other things. But the flip side of optimism is the thing I like about this country is our optimism. The thing I don't like about our country is our optimism. You know, because when things are good, we don't think they're going to get bad.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then when things are bad, we don't think they're going to get good, you know? And so that's the greed and fear thing. So a lot of people are saying, you know, so my thing that I'm talking to a lot of people, my clients at least, about right now is, you know, it's buy low, sell high. It's a market high, market low, market's high. Then what should you be doing? And they say selling. And I said, that's absolutely right. And people, our listeners, might be saying, what are you talking about? The market's getting ready to push through 20,000. Yeah, but the market is high. And so why would, you know, and the reason why people are staying in a market, because they're greedy, because they think it's going to go higher. And it may.
Sure.
It may. But like you said, that's what happened with Google, right? Google was going up. You decided to get out while the getting was good, but you made a ton of money, and you're happy with it, you know?
Right. And I think also I want to talk about this, because I think this is the other issue. People sometimes don't get out because they don't know any better.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, you talk about fear and greed. So, yes, greed is saying, hey, I want to make more money, and at the same time, the fear is if I get out, you know, I don't know when to get out, but if I do get out, I'm going to lose money.
Yeah.
I'm going to lose opportunity, I should say, better yet. So, yeah. I like that whole fear and greed are these huge drivers. So let's talk about this, because we only got a couple of minutes left. So what should I do? What should I be doing So I'm not ruled by fear and greed.
Well, you know, that's a good question. Of course, you know, I have to say it all depends upon the individual, right? Because the individual, you know, their age, their risk tolerance, what their goals and objectives are. I mean, if you're retired, for instance, if you've got all the income that you need, well, now it's a different situation than the person that has, you know, $1 million in the market and they don't have the income that they need. If they're just siphoning off that $1 million, that's a different thing than having income that they need. So, you know, all things, you know, there's a lot of things to take into consideration as well as the market. And a lot of people today, a lot of professional financial people today, they're taught in financial advisor school to put people in boxes and to sum them up by their age or whatever. And so we got these five boxes we can put these people in, and they go in box number three, you know. And, you know, to me, that's what gets back to what you started the program with our session here with is the coaching. You get somebody that's going to coach, customize things according to your situation, according to your plan, right? So a person obviously in retirement is going to have different motives, goals, dreams, situation than a 20, 30, 40-year-old is going to have.
Right.
So a 20, 30, 40-year-old can obviously have a whole lot more risk and aggressiveness in their life than the person who is, you know, 55, 65, 75, because those people have already attained their wealth. And now what I find typically their goal is to preserve their assets, to have the income that they need now and into the future, and to be able to pass them on in a way that they want to pass them on as far as their legacy goes. It's more of what I call the purpose-oriented approach to investing as opposed to the performance approach to investing, where you're trying to just make the money grow from $100,000 to $200,000 to $400,000, you know, that kind of thing. So that's a very good question. But, you know, because I work primarily with people in retirement and close to retirement, Bert, you know, the answer to your question, you know, if you're a person in retirement, I would ask you, well, are you a conservative investor or aggressive investor? And many times people say, well, I'm a conservative investor. And they say, well, how much do you think you should have at risk in the stock market right now? And they'll say, oh, 10%. And then I'll say, well, I'll look at their assets and I'll say, but you know how much you have at risk? They say, no. I say, you have 90% at risk. And I say, 90%. They'll say, 90% at risk. I say, yeah. But my financial person said, I'm conservative. I said, well, if we put a teeter-totter up and divided it into three sections, on the left-hand side is conservative, the middle is semi-risk, the right-hand aggressive, and we divide each one into those same categories, I said, well, you know, usually I say, well, so your idea of conservative is over here on the conservative end of this teeter-totter. Yes, that's right. Well, your financial person, they're aggressive by nature, so they've got you in the conservative end of aggressive. And so it's kind of like saying a conservative stock. There is no such thing. So it's going to be dependent upon what your goals are, what stage of life you're in. And typically what I do with my clients is we look at investing the old-fashioned way through dividends and interest and purpose orientation as opposed to growth orientation.
We have to go, but Andrew, I want to say thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to having you back again in January. We'll talk some more. Andrew and Jimmy, always good to have you on the show, my friend.
Thanks, Bert. Hey, Merry Christmas to you, too. Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.
Happy holidays. Good stuff there from Andrew about what to do with you and your money. And I love the idea that there's no real such thing as conservative stock. Anytime you put your money out there, it's at risk. Look, you can lose even in a great stock like Apple or Google, right? Now, it may continue to go up, and most likely it will, but you're putting your money at risk. Norma, goodbye, and thank you for joining us. If you guys could, they're on Facebook Live. Share this link with your friends. Share the video with your friends. I appreciate it. Forrest Grump, good to see you, my friend. Is it Zelnelda Souza? Good to have you here. Hopefully I didn't kill your name too bad. And Belma Souza. Hopefully I didn't crush your name either. But anyway, thank you everybody on Facebook Live for joining us. Kathy, Norma, Adam, Thank you so much, everybody. You can find us on Blog Talk Radio, on iHeartRadio, on iTunes. And remember, I want you guys to have some happy holidays, some Merry Christmas, some Happy Hanukkah. And most of all, remember that you were created.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.